Welcome to a special Around Noon presentation of the 2008 Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. Established in 1935 by Cleveland philanthropist Edith Anisfield Wolf, this annual award recognizes recent books that have made important contributions to our understanding of racism and our appreciation of the rich diversity of human culture. On the 7th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, four writers came to Northeast Ohio for an evening ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse presented by the Cleveland Foundation. Two winners took home the fiction prize, Pakistani writer Mohsen Hamid for his novel The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and Dominican author Juno Diaz for his fictional tale The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. This year's Lifetime Achievement Award winner is William Melvin Kelly, author of such Black Arts Movement classics as A Different Drummer and Dem. There was also a winner this year who was not listed in the awards program, Ayan Hirsi Ali, whose memoir, Infidel, won the Book Awards Nonfiction Prize. You'll hear more about her and all this year's winners during this hour as we share selections from the 2008 Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. We begin, though, with the host of the ceremonies, one of the members of the awards jury, acclaimed Ohio poet Rita Dove.
Novelists often present us with different or alternate perspectives on lives and events that we think we already know. And there is probably no other recent event that Americans in their collective consciousness are more familiar with and traumatized by than the one whose anniversary we commemorate today, 9/11. And there are no lives that, since the end of the Cold War, have puzzled and horrified us in the West as much as those of Islamic fundamentalists, so much so that we constructed clichés which conveniently turned complex, albeit terribly warped, individuals into one-dimensional stereotypes. For the past 7 years, we have been searching for narratives that make sense of 9/11 and its perpetrators, narratives that help us make sense of the day when American naivete seemed to collapse as swiftly and as surely as the towers. In The Reluctant Fundamentalist, his delicately constructed novel, Mohsen Hamid artfully presents us with a much more multifaceted perspective on the making of one such purported Islamist. And to do so, he employs a striking literary form. Essentially, the entire book is a dialogue in the form of a monologue, in which a Pakistani man, Cengiz, returning to his native Lahore after grand successes in the world of American higher education and of global business, tells the story of his life over tea and dinner to an American whose own motives for being in Lahore at this particular time and for sitting there with Cengiz remain unclear in a way that at once heightens tension and leaves the readers to their own shifting speculations. A pivotal part of the story is how Cengiz, despite his seeming immersion in Western culture, approached Islamic fundamentalism and how Islamic fundamentalism respectively approached him. Throughout the incessant and fascinating dialogue, with its literary roots in such divergent works as The Thousand and One Nights and The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, the American listeners' reactions, responses, and protestations are intimated only by Cengiz's words. I am honored to present the Anisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction to Mohsen Hamid for The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
Thank you, Rita. That was wonderful. Thank you to the judges of the Anisfield Wolf Book Award and to the Cleveland Foundation and to Cleveland for bringing me here. This award means a lot to me, and I think in part because it's an award in the United States that recognizes books on race, but partly also because of the people who have won it in the past. It is such an honor to be welcomed into that company. the company of writers that I've read growing up and respect so much. Also, I'm from Pakistan. I grew up in Pakistan, but I spent about half of my life before September 11th in the United States. I came to California in 1974 when I was three. My father was doing his PhD there. My family moved over. I went back to Pakistan in 1980 when I was nine, stayed there throughout school and high school, came back for college, lived in America more or less until 2001, and then left for England, where I now live, about 2 months before September 11th, 2001 took place. And so in 2001, I was literally, in terms of where I'd lived my life, half Pakistani and half American. And even though I don't have an American passport, there's no doubting that a great deal of me is American, and I have enormous affection for America. And so to be recognized in this way, in this setting, really feels to me like coming home. So thank you for that. I won't say too much about the book because you've already heard a lot, and I'll try to move things along so you can hear from the other writers as well. But I'll read a little bit. As Rita has told you, the novel is a monologue. So you're in a bazaar in Pakistan, in Lahore, and suddenly a Pakistani guy walks up, and he starts addressing this American stranger. And the Pakistani guy has a beard, the American stranger. We don't know why he's there. And we don't know the reason for this encounter. And the rest of the novel, basically, is their encounter. It's been described as a thriller, but nothing thrilling actually happens. And the reason why it can be a thriller is because the reason why it can make an audience afraid is because the novel works on the assumption that we're already afraid. You know, when we think of an American guy with a crew cut in a bazaar in Lahore talking to a Pakistani Muslim guy with a beard, what we feel is fear. The reality, of course, is that most such American guys and most such Pakistani guys mean absolutely no harm to one another. But that fear that exists is really what the novel plays with, and in so playing, asks you, the reader, to play a role in deciding what happens. But very quickly, I'll read from the very beginning of the novel so you get a sense of how it works, and then a little bit further on. Here's how it begins. "Excuse me, sir, but may I be of assistance? Ah, I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. I noticed that you were looking for something. More than looking, in fact, you seem to be on a mission. And since I am both a native of this city and a speaker of your language, I thought I might offer you my services. How did I know you were American? No, not by the color of your skin. We have a range of complexions in this country, and yours occurs often among the people of our northwest frontier. Nor was it your dress that gave you away. A European tourist could as easily have purchased in Des Moines your suit with its single vent and your button-down shirt. True, your hair, short cropped, and your expansive chest, the chest, I would say, of a man who bench presses regularly and maxes out well above 225, are typical of a certain type of American. But then again, sportsmen and soldiers of all nationalities tend to look alike. Instead, it was your bearing that allowed me to identify you, and I do not mean that as an insult, for I see your face as hardened, but merely as an observation. Come, tell me, what were you looking for? Surely at this time of day, only one thing could have brought you to the district of Old Anarkali, named, as you may be aware, after a courtesan immured for loving a prince, and that is the quest for the perfect cup of tea. Have I guessed correctly? Then allow me, sir, to suggest my favorite among these establishments. Yes, this is the one. Its metal chairs are no better upholstered. Its wooden tables are equally rough, and it is, like the others, open to the sky. But the quality of its tea, I assure you, is unparalleled. You prefer that seat, with your back so close to the wall? Very well, although you will benefit less from the intermittent breeze, which, when it does blow, makes these warm afternoons more pleasant. And will you not remove your jacket? So formal. Now that is not typical of Americans, at least not in my experience. And my experience is substantial. I spent 4.5 years in your country. Where? I worked in New York and before that attended college in New Jersey. Yes, you're right. It was Princeton. Quite a guess, I must say. What did I think of Princeton? Well, the answer to that question requires a story. When I first arrived, I looked around me at the Gothic buildings, younger, I later learned, than many of the mosques of this city, but made through acid treatment and ingenious stone masonry to look older, and thought, this is a dream come true. Princeton inspired in me the feeling that my life was a film in which I was the star and everything was possible. I have access to this beautiful campus, I thought, to professors who are titans in their fields and fellow students who are philosopher kings in the making. I was, I must admit, overly generous in my initial assumptions about the standard of the student body. They were almost all intelligent and many were brilliant, but whereas I was one of only 2 Pakistanis in my entering class, 2 from a population of over 100 million souls, mind you, the Americans faced much less daunting odds in the selection process. 1,000 of your compatriots were enrolled, 500 times as many, even though your country's population was only twice that of mine. As a result, the non-Americans among us tended, on average, to do better than the Americans. And in my case, I reached my senior year without having received a single B. Looking back now, I see the power of that system, pragmatic and effective, like so much else in America. We international students were sourced from around the globe, sifted not only by well-honed standardized tests, but by painstakingly customized evaluations, interviews, essays, recommendations, until the best and the brightest of us had been identified. I myself had among the top exam results in Pakistan and was, besides a soccer player, good enough to compete on the varsity team, which I did until I damaged my knee in my sophomore year. Students like me were given visas and scholarships, complete financial aid, mind you, and invited into the ranks of the meritocracy. In return, we were expected to contribute our talents to your society, the society we were joining. And for the most part, we were happy to do so. I certainly was, at least at first. And that's how it begins, a slightly uncomfortable encounter between this American and this Pakistani. Thank you, and I just want to read a little bit further on, very briefly, because the novel, although we've talked about it as a book about 9/11 and a book about politics and a book about many things, is a love story. It's a book about a man in love with a woman who perhaps is unable in the end to be in love with him, and about a man in love with America. And to give you a flavor for that, I want to tell you how this love story begins, and it begins when Cengiz, after graduating, goes to Greece on summer holiday with his friends from Princeton. And there's a woman there named Erica. And Cengiz has a crush on Erica. And here's how their romance kicks off. I was telling you about the moment when I was forced to stare. We were lying on the beach, and many of the European women nearby were, as usual, sunbathing topless, a practice I wholeheartedly supported, but which the women among us Princetonians, unfortunately, had thus far failed to embrace, when I noticed Erica was untying the straps of her bikini. And then, as I watched, only an arm's length away, she bared her breasts to the sun. A moment later, no, you're right, I'm being dishonest, it was more than a moment, she turned her head to the side and saw me staring at her. A number of possible alternatives presented themselves. I could suddenly avert my eyes, thereby proving not only that I had been staring, but that I was uncomfortable with her nudity. Or I could, after a brief pause, casually move my gaze away, as though the sight of her breasts had been the most natural thing in the world. Or I could keep staring, honestly communicating in this way my admiration for what she had revealed. Or I could, through well-timed literary allusion, draw her attention to the fact that there was a passage in Mr. Palomar that captured perfectly my dilemma. But I did none of these things. Instead, I blushed and said, "Hello." She smiled, with uncharacteristic shyness, it seemed to me, and replied, "Hi." I nodded, tried to think of something else to say, failed, and said, "Hello," again. As soon as I had done this, I wanted to disappear. I knew I sounded unbelievably foolish. She started to laugh, her small breasts bouncing, and said, "I'm going for a swim." But then, as she walked away, she half turned and added, "You want to come?" I followed her, watching the muscles of her lower back tense delicately to stabilize her spine. We reached the water. It was warm and perfectly clear, round pebbles and the flash of little fish visible below the surface. We slipped inside. She swam out into the bay with powerful strokes, then she trod water until I'd caught up with her. For a time, we were both silent, and I felt our slippery legs gaze each other as we churned the sea. "I don't think," she said finally, "I've ever met someone our age as polite as you." "Polite?" I said, less than radiant with joy. She smiled. "I don't mean it that way," she said. "Not boring polite, respectful polite. You give people their space. I really like that. It's unusual." We continued bobbing face to face, and I formed the impression that she was waiting for me to say something in reply, but words had abandoned me. Instead, my thoughts were engaged in a struggle to maintain a facial expression that would not appear idiotic. She turned and began to swim back to shore, keeping her head above water. I pulled alongside and, claiming victory at last over my cowering tongue, said, "Shall we return to town for a drink?" To which she replied, with a raised eyebrow and in an accent not normally her own, "I would be delighted to do so, sir. Thank you very much."
Mohsen Hamid, one of the two winners for the 2008 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction, which he took home for his acclaimed novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist. You're tuned to a special Around Noon presentation of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards here on 90.3 WCPN IdeaStream. Our next winner is Juno Diaz, the Dominican author whose acclaimed novel, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, also won him the 2008 Pulitzer Prize. Let's return to the Cleveland Playhouse's Bolton Theater as Rita Dove steps back to the podium to make the next introduction.
What can be said about The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, or about its author, Juno Diaz, that hasn't been said already? The book, with its magnificent mix of Spanish and English, ghetto and nerd, history and fantasy, high culture and low culture, Tolkien and everything else, seems to drive critics to their own adjectival feats. And to quote just a few, weirdly wonderful, nerdy wordy flair, deliciously casual and vibrant, relentless and capacious, panoramic and yet achingly personal, extraordinarily vibrant, highly flammable, and astoundingly great. But all critics seem to agree on one thing, that the novel was well worth the wait, coming as it did 11 years after Diaz's dazzling debut with his collection of short stories, Drown, that introduced us to this multi-voiced, keenly gifted writer. The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao is the story of the De Leon family, who live under the Fuku, the curse cast upon them by their brutalizing entanglement three generations ago with the Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo. It is also the coming of age story of a far from fabulous ghetto nerd whose inability to, well, get laid, defies every demand and explanation placed upon him by his culture. It is about strong women frustrated in their expression of their own passion. It is about Dominican history, Dominican diaspora, the gritty corners of New Jersey, and devotion to Lord of the Rings. One of the mandates of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards is to recognize outstanding works of literature that foster appreciation of the rich diversity of human cultures. Few novels have done that in recent memory as stunningly or audaciously as The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. And it is a privilege to present Juno Diaz with the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor. It's strange, when you're in the front row, you don't see all of you. Now I realize there's a tremendous amount of you. Yeah, Thank you for taking the time to come. I wanted to thank the Annisfield Wolf Book Award. I wanted to thank all the judges. I can tell this is a singular event for Cleveland, and I think it's absolutely important. There's so little that supports literature, it supports readers, because I think that the honor, of course, I feel deeply honored to be celebrated, but I think that's in some ways kind of incidental, you know? These awards, of course, really are about the fact that there is this great body of readers who love literature and are moved by it and support it and champion it and share it. And in the end, I think that us being up here is just kind of a proxy for the worth of y'all who are readers and whose cell phones work. Yeah? So, yeah. So, I will read very briefly. This is the kind of book, I mean, I always joke around with my friends because depending on what continent or depending on where you are, people have different reactions to literature. Of course, in the United States, there's a difficulty of grabbing, I think, sometimes the material of the book. So a lot of critics spend a lot of time talking about the language. They're like, there's Spanish in the book. They're like, wow. You know? It's like the literary equivalent of telling Obama, you speak so well. You know? It's like where of course in Santo Domingo where they don't really give a damn about any of that stuff, they assume there will be Spanish and they assume there will be English. In Santo Domingo they're obsessed more with the fact that this book is obsessed with the singular traumas of the New World, you know, which are like slavery and genocide. A funny ha-ha book about slavery and genocide, you know, which is kind of bizarre. I will not read from those sections. Yeah. I will instead read a tiny piece called Wildwood. Yeah. It's never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts, with your mother calling you into the bathroom. You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits were making the dash for the boat, and you did not want to stop reading. But then your mother called again, louder, her I am not fucking around voice, and you mumbled irritably, "Sí, señora." Your mother was standing in front of the medicine cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung around her like a sail, the scar on her back as vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book to pretend that you had not heard her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big smoky eyes that you will have in the future. "Ven acá," she commands. She is frowning at something on one of her breasts. For the record, your mother's breasts are immensities, one of the wonders of the world. The only ones that you've seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines and on really fat ladies. I should say the you in this is a 12-year-old Dominican girl named Lola. The breasts are 36 triple Ds, and the aureolas are as big as saucers and as black as pitch. And at their edges are fierce little hairs that sometimes your mother plucks and sometimes she does not. These breasts have always embarrassed you. And when you walk in public with your mother, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. Your father, your mother likes to brag, could never get enough of these. But given the fact that he ran off on her, it seemed in the end he could, yeah? You dread conversations with your mother. Those one-sided dressing downs. You figured that your mother has called you in to give you another earful about your diet. Your mother is convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary train-wrecking secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were 12 years old and already as tall as she was, a long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys have not been able to stop talking about since the fifth grade, but whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion too, which means that you are dark. But for all of your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angles, you are flat as a board. And you are thinking that your mother is going to order you to stop wearing bras again, because in her words, they are suffocating your potential breasts, discouraging them from developing. You are ready to argue with your mother to the death because you are as possessive of your new bras as you are of the pads that you can now buy yourself. But no, your mother does not say a word about eating more plátanos. Instead, she takes your right hand and guides you. Your mother is rough in all things, but this time she is gentle. You did not think her capable of it. Do you feel that? She asks you. At first, all you feel is the heat of her and the density of that tissue, like a bread that has never stopped rising. She kneads your fingers into her. You're as close as the two of you have ever been, and her breath is what you will remember. Don't you feel that? She turns towards you. Coño, muchacha del diablo, stop looking at me and feel. So you close your eyes, and your fingers are pushing down, and you are thinking, of course, of Helen Keller, and how, when you were a little girl, you wanted to be just like Helen Keller, except a little more nunnish, yeah? And then suddenly, without warning, you do feel something, a knot just beneath your mother's skin, tight and secretive as a plot. And at that moment, for reasons you will never quite understand, you are overcome by the feeling, the premonition, that something in your life is about to change. You become lightheaded, and you can feel a throbbing in your blood, a beat, a rhythm, a drum. Bright lights zoom through you like photon torpedoes, like comets. You do not know how or why you know this thing, but that you know it cannot be doubted. It is exhilarating. For as long as you have been alive, you have had bruja ways. Even your mother will begrudge you that much. Hija del Ivorio, she called you after you pictured Diaz winning lottery number for her. And you assumed that Liborio was a relative. That was before you started visiting Santo Domingo, before you learned about the great power of God. I feel it, you say too loudly. Lo siento. And like that, everything changes. Before the winner is out, the doctors remove the breast that you were needing along with the axillary lymph nodes. Because of the operation, your mother will have trouble lifting her arm over her head for the rest of her life. Her hair begins to fall out because of the therapy, and one day she pulls what remains out and puts it inside of a plastic bag. You change too. Not right away, but it happens. And it is in that bathroom where it all begins, where you begin. That's all. Thank you.
Juno Diaz, author of The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, which shared the 2008 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction with The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hamid. You're listening to a special Around Noon presentation of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, presented by the Cleveland Foundation and recorded on location at the Cleveland Playhouse. Our next winner is the recipient of the 2008 Lifetime Achievement Award, William Melvin Kelly. Ceremony host Rita Dove introduced him to the crowd.
In his 1965 New York Times review of William Melvin Kelly's novel, A Drop of Patience, the critic David Baroff wrote, quote, "A Drop of Patience is a moving, painful, and stinging experience. Kelly's prose is tight and spare, the novel's anger and bitterness straining against the stripped-down language." But then Baroff went on to find fault in what he perceived as, and I quote, a generic weakness in the Negro novel of the time. Namely, and here I am paraphrasing, I want to make sure you don't think this is my words, that despite their, quote, decided moral advantages, Negro novels should not emulate a civil rights rally. Well, 40 years later, Daryl Dixon Carr wrote of Kelly in his Columbia Guide to African American Literature, "Although William Melvin Kelly began writing and published his most celebrated works at the cusp and in the midst of the Black Arts Movement, his fiction tended to be far more surrealistic than much of the material emanating from that period, privileging aesthetics over politics. Although all of Kelly's fiction contains political elements that clearly comment upon the larger issues regarding American history, especially the role of African Americans within that history." Now, most likely, the 40-year gulf between these two divergent assessments accounts for their vastly different readings of William Melvin Kelly, winner of this year's Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Award. On the other hand, the tendency still persists among many readers, teachers, publishers, and scholars to view Black literature, no matter of which period, through a socio-political lens. But while it can often be illuminating and necessary to read politics into the compact but singularly accomplished body of Kelly's work, we should also take to heart his very own statement, and I quote, "I am not a sociologist or a politician or a spokesman. Such people try to give answers. A writer, I think, should ask questions." End quote. He never lost sight of cultural uniqueness, of the juxtapositions of white drawing on black and black drawing on white, while interpreting the panoply of signs and symbols that make up 20th century life. And therefore, it is my great privilege and pleasure to present the Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Award to William Melvin Kelly. Thank you so much.
I want to thank the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards for this Lifetime Achievement Award. As I said to Professor Gates when he phoned me, and I'm not even dead yet. I suspect I've received this award for work I did before 1970 when I published my last book. Some good work, but not as good as some I've done since then. After 1970, I began to have trouble getting my writing published. I have some theories as to why that happened, but haven't the time to explore them. Instead of a few things published each year, I now get one or two things published each decade. Of course, this bothered me until I realized that this made me more like a poet than a prose fiction writer. Poets don't expect to get many things published. They earn their money some other way, from practicing law or medicine or selling insurance or by teaching. I like teaching and dealing with young minds. I don't like people asking me if I still write. It assumes that a writer can publish everything that he writes, an absurd idea. So I do have a few things in my drawer in case anybody wants something. Let me read you the story that got published last decade. It appeared in the New Yorker in August 1997. I tried to edit it down to the time they've given me. If it runs a few minutes long, as a 70-year-old great-grandfather, I don't always have to conform. I'm going to read a story called Carlyle Tries Polygamy. Carlotta and Molly got along very well, better than most big and little sisters. Sometimes Carlyle borrowed his brother's Roadster sedan and, without telling their mothers, took the two girls anywhere they wanted to go, the beach or zoo or circus or rodeo or amusement park. He walked behind them, an unobtrusive shepherd, enjoying the sight of them whispering, cavorting, holding hands. Recently, their mothers had become jealous of each other. They had known each other of each other for the past 3 years. When Senegal had tracked him down to Gloria's house in the Bronx, demanding money for Molly's school uniforms. Before that, he had kept them separated in different parts of the city, Senegal in Brooklyn and Gloria in the Bronx. Once they learned about each other, they did not stop talking about each other. At times, the verbal struggle they waged in his ears became so intense that Carlyle would retreat to his sunny Harlem room and rest in his easy guy until his ears had repaired themselves. He would not see either woman for a week. His brother, who knew something of his dilemma, told him that the blessed Quran gave a man permission to maintain four women, which did not help Carlyle. Carlyle could barely manage two. "Then you must cut one loose, my brother. Keep the relationship with your offspring, but call it off with one of the mothers. You must choose." But Carlyle loved both women, Gloria for her mocha beauty and her fast mouth, Senegal for her chocolate beauty and her independent spirit, and he could not choose between them. But something had to change. Then one day he encountered Brother Ben, selling juice and astrology books at the corner of 125th Street and Frederick Douglass, and the brother launched into his tired polygamy rap, which goes, "Vietnam plus homosexuality plus prison plus heroin plus AIDS plus crack had so reduced the male African-American population as to make polygamy the only way for African-American culture to sustain itself. Each man had to accept his responsibility. Each woman had to realize that only by accepting the other women in her man's life could she get a man to call her own. Then, of course, once a man had gathered his women together, he might organize them to make dried flower arrangements or some such product." "But Brother Ben," Carla interrupted, "you have a nuclear family under your own roof, a wife you have loved for years, and two beautiful daughters like mine. And besides, no other woman would have you." Brother Ben blinked, but continued his rap undeterred as Carlyle ambled away. But Brother Ben had made one usable point. Perhaps Carlyle should bring together his two warring lady friends for a sit-down, give them the opportunity to say bad things to each other face-to-face, without making Carlyle's brain the battleground. Perhaps they could work out what he could not. At least they might blow off some bad gas. Carlyle arranged to have both meet him on a Tuesday evening at one of Harlem's few remaining gems, the Golden Grouse Bar and Restaurant. He liked breakfast better than dinner at the Grouse, but did not expect anybody to eat very much. However, red-clad Gloria tipped in first and quickly ordered an immense fried chicken dinner with scalloped potatoes and tossed salad and peach cobbler and the Grouse's special punch. Before her food had arrived, Senegal appeared in olive drab, her dreadlocks wrapped out and back like a praying mantis in the nationalist colors. She carried various tubs of her own Ital delicacies because she did not trust the cook at the Grouse to keep the bacon grease out of the peanut oil. The two women sat silently glaring across the table at each other and consumed all that the waitress and the Senegal had carried to the table. Near the end of the 30-minute meal, Senegal sampling the peach cobbler and Gloria quenching her thirst with the homemade ginger beer. Together they covered their belches and tittered. Then they put fire under his sorry brown butt. Thought the sight of this simple country cow pie would do what? But make I tell all the world that I, woman, never fear no old higgler till yet, nor see it. Sure don't see what jive hustle he think he pulling with this tired BS, but this sister came a long way to tell everybody that this just won't hardly go down. Because I love that I, woman, keeping for said man, spring from the most high mountain of New Zion. Besides, this brother have deluded himself into thinking because I love him that I mean I need him. When he too dim to see I got my own house at Barnes Avenue in the Bronx, all bought and paid for with mops and tips, and also by far the best of his never-do-nothing buttocks in his daughter Carlotta, which I, sister, can strenuously affirm and illustrate, as him give I woman nothing of value but sweet little Molly, and she quite valuable. They glowered at him. So now what, bumbersucker?
Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Award winner, William Melvin Kelly. You're listening to a special Around Noon presentation of the 2008 Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, recorded on location at the Cleveland Playhouse. Following Kelly's acceptance speech, the audience in the Bolton Theater began gathering their things as they prepared to leave for the evening. But Cleveland Foundation President Ron Richard surprised everyone when he stepped to the podium to tell the crowd to wait. There was one more prize to be handed out. As armed guards patrolled backstage and throughout the theater, the final unannounced winner entered the building to accept her award. Ayan Hirsi Ali has lived in exile since 2004, when her life was threatened by Islamic fundamentalists for her outspoken career as an advocate for women and passionate opponent to her former faith of Islam. As audience members sat up with renewed anticipation, host Rita Dove returned to the podium.
It is an honor to share this podium tonight with Ayan Hirsi Ali, the internationally renowned advocate for the rights of Muslim women and the author of The Caged Virgin, an impassioned collection of essays that came out 2 years ago, as well as her most recent book, her tremendously moving autobiography, Infidel. The outline of Ayan Hirsi Ali's life is well known by now, but it is worth reciting. Born in 1969 in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, as the daughter of an opposition leader against Siad Barre's dictatorship, Hirsi Ali experienced her first dislocation when her family went into exile in Saudi Arabia. In Somalia, the family, like many others, had practiced a form of Islam laced with native Somali spiritualism. It was orthodox enough in its own ways that her father had more than one wife and that she was circumcised upon entering adolescence. But it bore little resemblance to the strictness and restrictiveness of Saudi Arabian Islam, where female circumcision is not a traditional practice, an apparent contradiction which early on fostered the young girl's questioning of her faith. The family then relocated to Ethiopia briefly and on to Kenya. In both places, Hirsi Ali encountered color prejudice for the first time. As a teenager in Nairobi, she became an adherent to militant Islam. But even as she covered herself head to toe, The hustle and bustle of this large city gave her a glimpse of a world beyond the tight strictures her religion imposed on her and that she had imposed on herself. In 1992, at the age of 22, Hirsi Ali was on her way to an arranged marriage with a distant cousin in Canada when, during a visit with relatives in Germany, she fled over the border to the Netherlands, where she sought and obtained political refugee status. 11 years later, she was, as the Dutch-born writer Ian Burumo says, quote, perhaps the most famous politician in the Netherlands. Her public notoriety was a direct consequence of her outspoken questioning of her own faith and eventual conversion from Islam to atheism. Hirsi Ali's public statements against her erstwhile religion, a religion that she maintains has at its core the abuse of women and a militant intolerance towards secular cultures and individual freedom, raise the ire of Muslims, especially and most dangerously of violent Islamist extremists. William Grimes of the New York Times called her, quote, a feminine counterpart to Salman Rushdie, end quote. In 2004, she and the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh collaborated on the film Submission, about female subordination in Islamic society. As a result, Theo van Gogh was assassinated by a Muslim fanatic. Pinned to his body was a 5-page letter naming Hirsi Ali as the next target. Already under police protection at the time, her friend's murder forced her into hiding and to living under vast security measures, while her devastatingly gained prominence on the international stage led Time magazine to name her one of the 100 most influential people in the world. It is my great honor to present Ayan Hirsi Ali with the 2008 Nonfiction Award for Infidel.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, members of the Cleveland Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored, I'm humbled, I feel encouraged and acknowledged, and I'm very, very grateful to you for that. I was asked to read a few pages from my book in accepting this award, and I chose the following passages because I find myself a witness to how America is struggling with its race relationship, with its past of slavery. And I want to share with you, with all Americans, with anyone who can read and write and who hears me, that bigotry is not only a white man's disease, it's a universal disease. And probably the only way to get rid of it is to continuously examine oneself. But there's no self-examination possible if there can be no self, if we lock ourselves only up in groups. The job counselor sent me to learn bookkeeping in Wageningen, a village close to Ede. That was a very expensive course too, but it seemed to her to be the only option. I suppose she thought that the universal language of numbers would be easier for a foreigner to learn. I did horribly. After 4 weeks, my debit side would never matched my credit side. It still never does. The teacher sighed and said, this is really not for you. I said, I told them all along. So he wrote a letter saying I was not suitable for bookkeeping and I stopped attending class. I still wanted more than this life. I had decided I wanted to study political science. If that required going to university, then that's where I would go. Ellen and Hanneke thought I was mad. A degree? Sure. That was a fine ambition. But political science? I tried to explain that I wanted to understand why life in Holland was so different from life in Africa, why there was so much peace, security, and wealth in Europe, what the causes of war were, and how you built peace. I didn't have any answers, just questions. I thought about it all the time. Every contact I had with government, I thought, how do you get to have a government like this one? I watched Hanukkah and Ellen draw up schedules with other girls in the student house that they shared, lists of who would do the cleaning and the grocery shopping and cooking. And it was like the bus timetable. All the girls actually did their chores. And amazingly, there wasn't even conflict about it. How did you get to become this way? There were rules about everything in Holland. I got stopped by a policeman one evening for cycling without my lights on, and I froze, assuming something horrible was going to happen. But all I got was a firm but courteous lecture and a fine of 25 guilders. Moreover, the policeman said I wasn't supposed to pay the fine right away. It would come in the mail. Sure enough, a month later, I received a detailed bill. I thought about this system, how cleverly it prevented you ever giving a policeman money so he never got tempted to pocket it. Government was very present in this country. It could be bureaucratic, sometimes stupidly complex, but it also seemed very beneficial, and I wanted to know how you do that. This was an infidel country whose way of life we Muslims were supposed to oppose and reject. Why was it then so much better run, better led, and made for such better lives than the places where we came from? Shouldn't the places where Allah was worshipped and his laws obeyed have been at peace and wealthy, and the unbelievers' countries ignorant and poor and at war? I wanted to understand conflict. In 1992 and 1993, it seemed as if the whole world outside the West was breaking out in civil wars and tribal conflicts. The end of the Cold War had unfrozen old fault lines of hatred, and of all the countries where war had broken out, so many seemed to be Muslim. What was wrong with us? Why should infidels live in peace and Muslims be killing each other when we were the ones who worshipped the true God? If I studied political science, I thought I would understand that. It wasn't going to be easy to qualify. The government had accepted my O levels and Kenyan secretarial courses as equivalent to something just below high school, what you call high school in America. But even this was stretching it. To get into the university, I would need another qualification called a propedeuse. I panicked. I thought I could never pass the math. With Ellen's help, I figured out that the easiest way for me to get the propedeuse would be to study social work in a vocational college, as Ellen and Hanukkah did. That way, after a year, I could transfer to the university and avoid encountering too much math. I announced to my language school that I wanted to register for the Dutch language test that I would need to pass in order to attend the vocational college. My teacher was kind but told me condescendingly that it was far too early. I had been studying Dutch for only a year. People took 3 years. I was being impatient and irresponsible. It would be a waste of my money even to apply. Ellen told me the teacher had no right to prevent me. It was my money. So I went to the exam center in Nijmegen and registered to take the Dutch test anyway, and I passed. Vocational college could be my next step. All this time, I had mostly avoided other Somalis. Even when we were still living in the asylum center, I hadn't had much fun with them anyway. Everyone who hung out in Hassan's caravan seemed to spend all their time complaining, especially the people who lived outside the asylum center, who had been in Holland for years and were simply visiting. These Somalis were not integrating into Dutch society. They were not working. They had nothing to do but hang about the asylum seeker center and catch meals. There were a few individuals who learned to cycle, who were ambitious and studied and worked. I was not unique, but those people had no time to socialize. The others just chewed carts all night and sat around talking about how horrible Holland was. We were all facing the same confusion. We had always been sure that we, as Muslims and Somalis, were superior to unbelievers. And here we were, not superior at all. In day-to-day life, we didn't know how the cash machines worked or that you had to push a button in order to stop the bus. One time I took a bus together with Dahabo, another Somali asylum seeker. When it hurtled right on past where we wanted to go, Dahabo yelled, "Stop!" just as we did in Somalia. It was embarrassing. Many people withdrew from such embarrassment into an enclave of shared Somaliness. Their reaction was to create a fantasy that they, as Somalis, knew better about everything than these inferior white people. "You don't need to teach me anything about thermometers. Our Somali thermometers are far more advanced." That kind of attitude. His breath smells of pigs. Ironically, Somalis probably have never seen pigs, let alone smell its breath. He's only a bus driver. How dare he think he can tell me how to behave? In my first weeks at the asylum center, as I was standing in a crowd of Somalis just outside Hasna's caravan, someone called out to us, "There's a man crying on television." We rushed to the television, and it was a program called I Am Sorry, where people confessed things. A huge, broad-shouldered Dutch man, red-faced and squeaky-voiced, was weeping. Weeping tears over something he had done. He whimpered, "I am so sorry." And we stared at each other in horror and wonder. I'm sure none of us had ever seen a man cry. Then we burst out laughing. This country was so strange to us. Thank you.
Ayan Hirsi Ali, the surprise winner of the 2008 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Nonfiction, which she received for her acclaimed memoir, Infidel. You've been listening to a special Around Noon presentation of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, recorded live on Thursday, September 11th, 2008, at the Cleveland Playhouse. Thanks to the Cleveland Foundation and its president, Ron Richard, for inviting us to record and broadcast this ceremony, and to Color Tone Staging and Rentals for assisting in that recording. Also thanks to Laura Scharf of Landau Public Relations and Mary Louise Hahn for their help with this broadcast. This program was produced by Dave DiOrio. I'm Dee Perry. Thank you for joining us for this special presentation of the 2008 Annisfield Wolf Book Awards.